Welcome to episode 187 of the Microsoft Cloud IT Pro Podcast, recorded live on July 14th, 2020. This is a show about Microsoft 365 and Azure from the perspective of IT pros and end users, where we discuss a topic or recent news and how it relates to you. In this episode, Ben and Scott cover some recent Microsoft 365 news, including Azure AD Alternate Login ID, Sensitive by Default in SharePoint and OneDrive, and some other security-related news. It's Wednesday. This has me all thrown off my game because I'm going on vacation and I'm not
going to... It's not even Wednesday. It's only Tuesday.
Yeah, see, I told you. Tuesday has me all thrown off my game because I am going on vacation to a remote cottage in Michigan to enjoy the sun and the sand and the water and social isolation from everyone, including a cell phone signal.
You got to do what's got to be done.
Yes. I'm actually looking forward to it. My parents have a cottage up there. I have not seen it yet. So they got it like a year ago. And I have not been up there to visit or to see the cottage because last time we were up there, it was winter and just, you don't go up there in the winter. Well, you could, but my kids would not have enjoyed it as much as I would have.
I think it's safe to say one does not go to Michigan in the winter, let alone to the cottage, the remote cottage in Michigan.
In Michigan. One absolutely goes to Michigan because there is snow to play in.
Yeah.
Snowmobiling to be had, sledding to be done, snowboarding, all of the fun winter sports.
Yeah, kind of, sort of. You could almost go find yourself a real mountain.
I could. I could just go to Denver instead, or to Utah, or Montana, Canada, all of the above. Definitely have better skiing, but they're also a little bit more expensive and I don't have family there.
The Northwest, a little bit of Europe. Eh, you bring the family with you.
I have always wanted to go to the Alps to go skiing. My brother has done it. I have not.
I will not discourage you.
Perfect.
You should live for your dreams.
No, I just have to convince my family. I need to get all my kids skiing. Do you know how hard it is to teach kids to ski and snowboard in Florida?
I do, as I've been flying mine around too to do the same thing.
Yeah, once they get a little older, we'll teach them, we'll get them, and then I'll go to Switzerland. And
I'm going to teach them how to ride the one wheel, because that's not like snowboarding, but it's close.
Is it? How close is it? Because I believe you have had the privilege of riding a one wheel a lot.
I mean, I bought one, so yeah. Now I got to get my money's worth out of it.
Yes. Well, but do you get to ride it, or have your kids hijacked it?
No, I ride it.
Okay. Is it like snowboarding then?
Not quite with the stock tire that comes on it. I think I need a different tire to make it feel a little bit more like that, but it is super fun. It's definitely a thing that you can get into with potentially like a deeper carve than a longboard. It's different than skateboarding or snowboarding or skiing or any of those things, but it's definitely fun. It's kind of addicting.
I might have to add that to my Christmas list, birthday list, when I stop buying Lego sets.
Outlook add-ins are a great way to improve productivity and save time in the workplace, and Sperry Software has all the add-ins you'll ever need. The Save as PDF add-in is a bestseller and is great for project backups, legal discovery, and more. This add-in saves the email and attachments as PDF files. It's easy to download, easy to install, and Sperry Software's unparalleled customer service is always ready to help. Download a free trial at sperrysoftware.com, SperrySoftware.com, and see for yourself how great Save as PDF is. Listeners can get 20% off their order today by entering the code CLOUDIT. That's CLOUDIT, CLOUDIT, all one word at checkout. Sperry Software, work in email, not on email.
So, in other news, should we talk about cloud news?
Yeah.
We could just turn it into the Rambling Guys podcast.
No, there's been a bunch of fun stuff with Azure AD.
There has been. So this was one, I think it came out yesterday. So it came out Monday, July 13, because I saw it right before I crawled in bed last night. And this one is that using some PowerShell now, you can go in and enable user-friendly sign-in to Azure AD with email as an alternate login to an ID, as an alternate login ID, which is normally your UPN. So this is interesting because I still talk to clients that just assume they're always using their email because they don't realize email and UPN are 99% of the time the exact same in Office 365. But in reality, your UPN and your email do not have to match up one for one. And Microsoft just, I would say they kind of encourage you to keep the same because it does tend to lead to less confusion for people when your UPN and your email address are the same thing.
True story.
So now with this one, you don't have to do that, which can come in handy, especially when it comes to some of those cases where you have trusted domains. Because I was thinking through this last night and making sure that it all made sense in my head, is a lot of times you may have two different domains. You have, well, two different domains. You can't have the same UPN suffix in the two different domains. So people run into problems because you can only have, because of how Azure AD Sync works, you can only put it on one server. You have to trust your domains. You have to sync all your users up. And then they end up with different UPNs or different email addresses. Now you could, in theory, sync two different domains with two different UPNs, set the same email address for all the users, and let them use that single email address as their login ID instead of having separate UPNs from separate domains. Did I think through all that properly?
I'm still confused as why you'd want to. You'd be losing the ability for per user resolution. Like if every user had the same email address and you turn this on, what user would it resolve to when they log in?
So not the same, sorry, I probably phrased that wrong. Not the same user, but users from two different domains with two different UPNs all having the same email domain. So think your UPN is user one at company A, and then you have user B at company two, but they could both have user one at parentcompany.com and user two at parentcompany.com is their email address, and now use that to log in, even though their primary UPN suffix is different.
Correct. And it should still resolve back. So I haven't turned this one on yet, but it looks like what it's using is any addresses that resolve in the proxy addresses attribute. So as long as you've got that in there, you'd be kind of cleared and ready to go. So it certainly helps out in situations like that. I've worked with a number of organizations where sign-in IDs do not equate to email addresses in any way, shape, or form. Like every law firm I've worked for, almost 99% of the time, my login for Active Directory was just an employee ID. Lots of like financial institutions were that way. So, you know, you'd be a number to log into your computer, and then you'd have your email address and all the other things on the other side, which led to all those customizations of, like you said, swapping an email address and sending it up as the UPN attribute through AD Connect. And weirdness ensues because users have two different login names and everything else. So effectively with this, you can still keep your UPN. Your users still resolve to their UPN, but theoretically anything that's a match within a proxy addresses attribute should go ahead and get them through. But certainly you wouldn't want to end up in that situation where multiple users have the like same email address and proxy addresses, because I don't know how it would resolve.
Yes.
Does the first one win? Does a random one win? That could be a little weird.
Yes. I misspoke there when I was talking about users with the same email addresses. I meant just users with the same domain.
I totally get where you're going with it. You're still going to have some weird user behavior, I think, with this one, because you're logging in with the email address and you're effectively, what you're doing is you're using that address for home realm discovery and then relying on things like synced passwords in Azure AD to go ahead and pick things up. So this isn't going to work if you have ADFS because, well, you'd still be redirected through Home Realm Discovery or HAD to your ADFS server. But then in ADFS, you're going to have to use your real login and password. This is you sync your passwords and do password hash synchronization and all that stuff to Azure AD. And you're relying on kind of that as a login mechanism. And then once you've logged in with your email address, you're still resolving to your UPN. So, you know, if you log in with ben.stejink, but your bstejink is your actual username, that's still what's going to show up inside of the sweep bar and things like that when you go to your profile.
Yes. And it does look like you were saying, it can be any proxy address. So it's not just your primary SMTP, but in theory, if I had Stedgink is my UPN, and I had an email address that was Ben Stedgink and Ben and B Stedge and all of those. I could, in theory, use any of those email addresses
in theory
to log in.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right. I've not turned this on and tried it yet. I should definitely do that, because why wouldn't I want to try something that just came out in preview in my primary tenant?
I thought that's what your primary tenant was there for.
Oh, it is. You should see the fun I have with my primary tenant because of all the different preview features that are lit up in it. Can be somewhat unpredictable at times. But yeah, I like this update. I think there's a lot of different scenarios this can help with. And then you combine this with like the cloud provisioning that's still in preview, and you start getting lots of options when you do have multiple domains. Or like you said, if you want to keep that UPN and login ID different.
Yeah. And flexibility is a good one here, right? I think it's a feature that unblocks a couple of scenarios, and they're important scenarios. And if you can make it easier to start synchronizing your data and onboarding, that just kind of accelerates you into ultimately the licensing you bought anyway. You didn't buy Microsoft 365 so you could figure out how to synchronize identity to it. You probably bought it for email or for SharePoint or Teams or something else along the way. So if you can accelerate along, why not?
And there are things to be careful of with this. There are still some limitations in preview that are covered in the documentation. One of these, Scott, I know this is going to shock you, B2B invites. So guest users, if they accept an invite sent to an email as an alternate login ID, and they sign in with an alternate email, your guest access through the whole tenant endpoint may not work. Imagine that, guest access not working with something like this.
Yeah, I could imagine that one's a little weird, and who knows how they solve that over time. But ultimately, because you're still signing into your Azure AD tenant, you're going to need some type of resolution over in that other tenant. So if you've enabled alternate login, but I haven't enabled alternate login, how is my tenant going to know to sign me in when all I'm coming over with is my email address?
Right. Yeah, that one does get weird. And there's some other ones in there. Kind of like you had said, it may still show the UPN instead of the email when you logged in different places.
Which I think is fine. I'd want it to show my UPN and not my email address.
How would how would this work with something like Teams when you're doing Teams calling and technically it's using a SIP address?
I don't know.
I don't either. That would be another interesting scenario. You were supposed to know. Because in theory, a lot of times your SIP matches your email, but your SIP doesn't even have to match your email and your login ID. So technically doing a Teams call, you might have to use that UPN yet, or make sure your SIP address gets updated if everybody's using and familiar with their email for their primary login. I think Microsoft recommends SIP and email being the same though.
Yeah, this doesn't do anything to negate good metadata and kind of attribute hygiene within your directories, whether it's your on-prem directory or your cloud directory, right? If you've gone down a path where SIP addresses are really weird, and like you said, they don't match UPNs or email addresses, then sorry, that's on you. You've taught all your users how to dial in a different way.
Right. Well, I was just thinking, like, if your SIP address matches your UPN and then everybody uses their email address to log in. And again, that's why Microsoft tends to recommend UPN and email and SIP all stay the same, because technically this, I think your UPN and your SIP would tend to stay the same and your alternate login, your email would be something different. But that is another scenario I can think that you may want to be cautious with.
Yes.
Did you have another Azure AD one that you wanted to talk about?
I've seen a couple of things pop up over the last few days when it comes to just kind of back to that hygiene thing and kind of metadata and making sure things are where they need to be, that help you do things like find expiring service principles within your directory. So we've been talking a lot on the side about things like managed identities and getting these services to talk to each other in Azure. Managed identities don't work for anything, or you're creating maybe like applications in your Azure AD and you've got that application ID and that client secret that you need to maintain. It's helpful to understand when those are coming up for expiration and when you potentially need to renew them and reconfigure your applications to get them to where they need to be. So I've been kind of playing around with some of that myself, and I can put a couple of quick scripts in the show notes for this one to do things like find those expired service principles. Another one that I thought was interesting that I saw pop up on Twitter for Azure AD hygiene was a quick little snippet of PowerShell that can help you go ahead and just audit your granted oath permissions within your tenancy. So if you had a user, like say you enable user consents for, you know, you just leave them open blanket maybe because you haven't locked that down. It's helpful to periodically check those and see what applications users have consented to, and especially any kind of persistent grants that have been made out there. It's kind of like the same thing you might do in Exchange, where you want to check and make sure that users don't have, you know, like SMTP forwarding addresses that are going to weird Gmail addresses or things like that along the way. But I think it's always good to kind of think about how you operationalize those workloads and get them to where they need to be.
Yeah, no, I agree. Like I've gone into my Azure AD tenant before and looked at some of what I've granted to my tenant in my account. And I'm like, oh, I kind of forgot that I had granted that application or that third-party service, those rights back like 6 years ago, and maybe I don't want them to still be there. So to be able to go through, run these scripts, check that health, that security, who might have been granted access in various ways, is definitely something that should probably be done on a regular basis, much more regularly than I do at my own tenant. And whenever you can script it and send that output somewhere to keep an eye on it, even better.
Yeah. Automate all the things, right? It's not hard to do. And, you know, now that we've got all this extra time on our hands, you know, make it happen.
I don't know who has extra time on their hands.
Well, I mean, come on. You just made it easier for your users to log in. You don't even need to go reconfigure Azure AD Connect anymore once you do this.
That's true. So I can go take your scripts, which these are really nice, short, concise scripts that can be used for that.
Do you feel overwhelmed by trying to manage your Office 365 environment? Are you facing unexpected issues that disrupt your company's productivity? IntelliJink is here to help. Much like you take your car to the mechanic that has specialized knowledge on how to best keep your car running, IntelliJink helps you with your Microsoft Cloud environment because that's their expertise. IntelliJink keeps up with the latest updates in the Microsoft Cloud to help keep your business running smoothly and ahead of the curve. Whether you are a small organization with just a few users up to an organization of several thousand employees, they want to partner with you to implement and administer your Microsoft Cloud technology. Visit them at IntelliJink.com/podcast. That's IntelliJink.com/podcast for more information or to schedule a 30-minute call to get started with them today. Remember, IntelliJink focuses on the Microsoft Cloud so you can focus on your business.
So I have another security announcement that I saw and I've been playing with, and I talked to somebody about this because didn't even realize this was an option. So this applies to data loss prevention in Office 365, Microsoft 365, whatever we want to call it.
I think we're supposed to call it Microsoft 365.
You work there now. What is the official, are we always supposed to use? Okay, we'll always use Microsoft 365. We'll stick
with
that.
Let's go with that for now.
Okay, we'll go with that for now. Data loss prevention in Microsoft 365 is that whole concept of I want to store certain information in SharePoint. Maybe I'm a doctor's office, I'm putting in patient records, I'm a financial institution, I am putting in credit card numbers, bank account numbers. These types of things are being stored within documents in SharePoint. Maybe your people could send them out via email, you're using it via Teams. This announcement applies specifically to OneDrive and SharePoint because you obviously may not want that information to be shareable. That's the whole data loss prevention part of it. Prevent that information from being shared. Maybe it's internally, maybe it's externally. But either way, you want to put these policies in place to protect that sensitive information, PII, HIPAA, financial information, whatever that sensitive information may be. in the past, or even today, I guess the way data loss prevention still works and the way it finds that information is taking advantage of search under the covers. So you put information in there, search goes out and runs as it's indexing all your content. It is finding the sensitive information, and then it uses that information that it has grabbed from search to say, no, you're not allowed to share this document externally. No, you're not allowed to email this document or link to this document from SharePoint, from OneDrive. However, we all know how search works, especially when it comes to SharePoint, and that there is a delay there. In SharePoint Online, you don't always know how much that delay is. Usually what I've seen, it's about 20 to 30 minutes before a new content is picked up and your data loss prevention would apply, which means that if you uploaded a document, went to share it externally right away, you could actually get sensitive information out of SharePoint, sharing it externally by sharing it as soon as you uploaded it. Microsoft recognized this problem, and there has been a feature that's been in preview for a while now called Sensitive by Default. And it just hit GA about a week ago. This announcement was from July 7 of 2020. And this applies to both OneDrive and SharePoint now that it's GA. The preview was actually just SharePoint and they didn't have a timeline on OneDrive. Lo and behold, it hit GA and you get it for both. What this does is as soon as you upload a document to SharePoint or OneDrive, it's immediately marked sensitive, regardless of what information is in there. So as soon as it's uploaded, it's unable to be shared. It is locked, it's classified as sensitive, and then it waits until search has a chance to process it and verify that it's safe. And at that point in time, you're now able to share that document out. It's not marked as sensitive anymore, and it wouldn't get caught by a data loss prevention policy that applies to sensitive information. So they kind of flipped it. If you go into PowerShell and mark new files sensitive by default, now instead of being able to share them until they're classified as sensitive, they're classified as sensitive until they're deemed safe, and then you can go in and share them. Downside is this only applies to new files. There's no way to go in and set all your old files sensitive by default. Hopefully, if you have DLP on, and you have old files in there, they've already been searched and classified sensitive or not anyways. So it doesn't, you don't necessarily need this for old files, but it does help with that potential data leakage of sensitive files that was there in the past in SharePoint and OneDrive.
Yes. And it's a requirement that you turn DLP on to start using this, right? Because like you said, it does use that as kind of an engine on the back end.
Yes.
So if you have an onboarding in DLP, this might be a nice, easy kind of on-ramp to figure some of that out.
Yeah, exactly. So I would recommend if you have any sensitive information out there and you're using DLP in any form or fashion, you should go turn this on today. Because if you don't, you do have a potential vulnerability there.
Yep. I think you do that. And like you said, be mindful of what it's going to do with that kind of lockdown concept initially until the indexer has a chance to grab things. You just need to be aware that now you could potentially have users sharing files out and then maybe opening something like a help desk ticket with you and saying, hey, Ben, I shared my file 15 minutes ago. And, you know, the person I sent it to says they can't get into it even though they got the link.
Yep, exactly. And they do say in this announcement too that they have been able to get the performance to be a little bit better. So they say 95% of the cases, the entire process should be done in less than 5 minutes.
I would not take that as any type of promise, though.
No, there's no SLA.
Because there is no SLA, like you said, around indexing.
Right. It's just kind of what they've seen. It could be more, it could be less. You could fall into the 5% of cases. There's no guarantee there. So like you said, Scott, you do have to be aware that you could get users that are unable to access files and you have to wait a little bit longer before they can get to them. Or they may have actually contained sensitive information and they shouldn't be able to access them anyways. Or you had a false positive in DLP, which also could happen.
Never happens. I mean, sometimes happens. Maybe more than once.
Was that kind of like in 95% of the cases it should, as maybe sometimes, yes. Never possibly?
Yeah. It goes back to that whole 76% of all statistics are true.
I thought the 76% were made up.
Well, you know, it depends.
All right. What else do we have?
We can keep talking about Microsoft 365 stuff. So particularly in the lens of kind of going down that security path again, the new version of Microsoft Secure Store has been GA'd. So if you've been paying attention, there was a public preview of the new Secure Score that came out earlier this year, and it's certainly been kicking around for at least the last 6 months or so. And now that global rollout is complete, so you can get your gamification on with improving the security posture of the workloads that you choose to leverage within your Microsoft 365 tenant. Wow, that's like a lot.
That was a
loaded statement.
That was like a mouthful.
Cloud's getting hard.
And this is the new... See, this is where I get confused. I have so many different versions of the Security Center and the Compliance Center.
This isn't Security
this
Center.
This isn't the whole center. This is just the scoring part of...
Correct.
...the new Security Center. I'm looking at screenshots from the article. And this looks like, is this still in the old Security and Compliance Center, or is the new Secure Score only in the new Security Center? Because some people, I think, are still kicking around in the old Security and Compliance Center as well.
I've only been using the new one, so I haven't been in the old one in a while.
I haven't either, but every once in a while it still shows its face. But all the screenshots of this are showing it in the new Security Center, which is security.something. Security.Microsoft, security.office, security.microsoft.com. I believe. Oh, again, I can't keep track. But yeah, there's some new areas they focused on in this release. They improved the assessment and scoring models. They added some planning, workflow, and posture monitoring improvements, added metric trend reports to drive meaningful planning and status discussions with leadership.
I think this new one is positioned in a way, or at least the data is positioned, to make it more actionable, potentially for security professionals within your organization. So the older or kind of previous versions of Secure Score, they would give you a number, and it was always very hard to quantify that number within your organization, especially as kind of compared to all the other orgs out there. Sometimes it really just didn't matter. So now what the new version does is you can kind of decide what metrics you want to bubble to the top or what you want to make important with in there. So you've got things like the actions to review card, where you can come in and understand very quickly where maybe your overall tenant configuration, its security posture has regressed in some way because you've decided to make some change. Right? Like hypothetically, you go and enable alternate login IDs and Microsoft flags that as something that's going to potentially make your score lower. I don't know whether that's true or false, but you know, just as an example, you do get, I think, a little bit of a better view of the world. And certainly it's also more condensed. So you get more data at once to hopefully understand where you want to take things within your tenant. I still think it's very important to understand that you're dealing with a number here that Microsoft has opted to provide as a piece of functionality within Microsoft 365. It might not be a number that's relevant to you, or the way it's presented, it might make it look worse than it actually is for you. So you need to kind of take all that with a grain of salt and weigh it out.
Yep. Exactly. I was looking down through some of what they've added because, again, I frankly can't always keep track in my head what's new and what's not. It looks like they've added a lot more space and created room to add a lot more details on your different improvement actions. So if you're going to, say, require MFA for 80 privileged roles, there's currently a lot more white space on the page so that they can add more details in the future around kind of a high-level overview of what it is, and then giving you options to that you accept the risk, that you want to resolve it, that you're planning it. It has some details around the user impact, and then documentations on documentation on kind of how to implement it to meet that specific action or that specific checklist on your security plan to go make the necessary fixes and changes if you want to implement that particular item.
Yeah, I think that's probably one of the better things here is you can start to use the new secure score as a way to come up with those action plans. So they have kind of included functionality to turn it into a little bit of a planning tool for what are we going to do? What are we not going to do? So you can do things like for a suggested improvement, you have certain statuses that are available that you can mark things as. You can say, you know, this is something that we plan on working on. You know, it makes sense for us. This is something that's still to do. And for this other thing, we're just going to accept that risk. Like for our organization, you know, it really doesn't impact us or it's not important. So we just want to turn that one off and not have it bubble up anymore. Maybe until the next time a new feature comes out around it.
Yep. And it looks like, too, another one that I haven't seen this before is your ability to change your own score zone. It kind of goes back to what you were saying about how Microsoft kind of picks a number and kind of the baseline they set may not be 100% where your metrics are. So you can go in and customize your own score zone. So you can say a score is bad in our organization if our secure score is less than or equal to 30%. And it's good if it's greater than or equal to 50% or 60%. And then it's okay between those percentage points. So it kind of gives you your ability to define your own risk tolerance there. For instance, like my environment has a secure score of 41.62%. So I think by and large, I don't know that I've ever seen anybody hit 100%. And it's really, really hard to get up in those higher percentages for your secure score. So by adjusting those, you can actually show, hey, even though it says 41%, we're still in a really good place from a security standpoint based on what our specific tolerances are for where we want to be with that secure score.
Yes, I think that's important. Another thing to recognize too is that there are multiple products within Microsoft 365, which are potentially giving you these numbers that equate to actions you might want to take within your environment. So while this new release of Secure Score has this quote-unquote improved scoring model, that hasn't made its way through the rest of the ecosystem. So there's other components or there's other things that have secure score in the name, like identity secure score, which is different than Microsoft Secure Score, and particularly different in the way that they're calculated. So if you're relying on something like that, just be mindful that those are different. If you are pulling information out of the Graph API, that might be different than the information that's presented within the new Secure Score. So you just have to make sure you're mindful of where the data is coming from and have a way to kind of aggregate it together for yourself. And I think that's one of the things, like they should always put a big disclaimer at the top of these. Like, you know, we've said it a bunch of times, but numbers are just numbers. You have to decide how impactful they are.
Right. Well, and there's an Azure Secure Score too, right? That's also different than this.
That's totally different. Yeah. And then there's Security Center and yeah, no, we can't.
Yes.
All very different.
Yeah, they are. But a nice improvement, nice updates to the Secure Score in Microsoft 365. So I think that'll wrap it up for today.
Yeah.
That covers some fun new security improvements coming to or now GA'd in your Microsoft 365 tenant.
Coming to a tenant near you.
Yes. So go enjoy your day. Get some work done. Stay safe. Stay healthy. And
all the things.
Yes.
Go ride my one wheel.
We will be coming to you from Michigan for the next couple podcasts. I will be recording remote on location in Michigan.
Can't wait to see how good your cell phone works.
Well, at my parents' house, I'll be fine. Just not at the cottage. Parents' house will be good to go. But my audio might not be good because there's no way I'm packing this mic to go to Michigan. I will be using my headset. So go enjoy your day. Enjoy the rest of your week. And we'll talk to you next week or in 2 weeks, whenever we talk again.
Thanks, Ben.
If you enjoyed the podcast, go leave us a 5-star rating in iTunes. It helps to get the word out so more IT pros can learn about Office 365 and Azure. If you have any questions you want us to address on the show or feedback about the show, feel free to reach out via our website, Twitter, or Facebook. Thanks again for listening and have a great day.